Hi, my name's Rageville, and I'm running for president. My platform is immortality for everyone or die trying. Now, show me the meaning!
Hell yeah.
That guy for president.
That guy for president. I think he said his name was Rachel, but, you know, I had everybody call in and give their own show me the meaning yells, and this was our Mr. Rachel, if that is in fact his name, was our first contestant. So, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast. My name is Jared, and I'm joined here by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan in studio, finally.
What up, film fans? It's great to be back.
And with us today, we have a wisecrack writer that you guys have probably never seen before. We have Tommy Cook with us. Tommy is a dear friend of the company and someone that Ryan and I both went to college with. How's it going, Tommy?
I'm good. Thank you for having me for the first time.
Yeah, so Tommy has written a number of our videos. Tommy's also a film critic for Collider, or reporter, what would you call yourself?
I'm more freelance, but yeah.
Freelance something, yeah, for freelance Collider. Something.
Welcome, Tommy.
Oh,
welcome,
thank Tommy. You, Ryan.
And he also has been a writer's assistant on a number of network TV shows. So he's a real legit pro here that we have.
Oh, gosh, no.
Yeah. Anyway, today we're going to be talking about The Punisher: Warzone, the 2008 film directed by Lexi Alexander, starring Ray Stevenson and Dominic West. By the way, did you know that Lexi Alexander is a girl who used to be in MMA?
I did know all of that, because Lexi Alexander fucking rules.
I'd never heard of her.
Out of control.
She's very prominent on Twitter. So
yeah.
Oh, see, I'm not on Twitter, so I don't know these things. But
I love that.
As always, let's go around and get first impressions. What was it like the first time you saw this movie? What was it like revisiting it for this podcast? Let's start with Ryan.
I believe we watched this for the first time together. Did we not?
I had seen it before. I know I maybe, told you to watch it.
Okay, maybe you were the one that begged me to watch it. And man, I'm glad I did. I feel like I have to obligatorily say this every time we have a superhero movie. I don't like superhero movies, but this one is awesome.
Okay.
And yeah, like I think Lexi Alexander just came into the material just totally from a different point of view and made a, I would call it the darkest comedy version of a, it's a super dark comedy, but super brutal. And what more, you know, here's how much I love this movie so much. I could have gone to see Limp Bizkit tonight at the Troubadour, but instead, I came here because I love Punisher Warzone, and I wanted to talk about it with you guys. So
that, I can't tell I if you're being just sarcastic about Limp Bizkit.
No, they're playing tonight. It was a $3 well, no, show, y'all.
$3
show?
Yeah.
That's a steal.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And what was it like revisiting it?
It was amazing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was funny because I wouldn't recommend this for most movies, but like sometimes when we watch these movies or I rewatch these movies for the podcast, I watch them on like a little bit faster speed. This movie is hilarious to watch at like 1.3 speed, you know, because everything is just so much more just like rapid fire and brutal.
Okay.
So that was my big takeaway from the rewatch was watch it faster.
You can skip the dialogue.
Good
that
to
way.
Know. Yeah. Yeah.
No, you can still hear the dialogue. It's just a little. It's just a tiny bit chipmunky.
Oh, believe me, when we do have an episode on an anime that has like 60 episodes, I'm very familiar with 1.3 speed.
Yeah.
All right, Tommy. What about you? What was like the first time you saw this movie?
Yeah, this is the second time I've seen this movie. So the first time I saw it, when this movie was actually released, I remember it got really terrible reviews.
Yeah.
And like Lionsgate buried it, as I recall. Like it was just like barely in theaters. Mm-hmm. So like when I first saw it, I had just heard rumblings of actually the cult following had like just begun. So like online I was hearing like, oh, you know, Punisher Warzone is actually pretty good. Everyone's wrong. And me being the me needing to be contrarian was like, oh, I cannot wait to like Punisher Warzone. So the first time I saw it, I was sort of I think I was a little underwhelmed. I didn't really think much of it. And then this second viewing of it, I've now come onto the side of really not liking this movie.
Really and not
really,
liking it. So you didn't like it. Now
really,
you like
now,
it even less.
I like it even less.
Celebration
I know.
Of this.
I know.
Movie.
I didn't want to bring everybody down.
You got
but,
a hotel
it's okay.
Zone
it's okay.
This?
You
got
to keep it real.
I really just don't quite get this movie. Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. So the first time you saw it, it was already on DVD. You didn't go see it in the
theater. Yeah, no, I saw it on DVD, and I thought, I just sort of put it aside. Like, I watched it, and I was like, well, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And now the second time, I've now really come to dislike it.
Interesting. That's fair. So I actually am the only one out of us three who saw it in the theaters. Mm. And I actually had the opposite experience that you had. There was a friend in town. This is back when I was in high school. Or no, 2008. So I was back home from college, like winter break or something like that. And all my friends, big group of friends, said we're going to go see a movie. And for some reason, the only movie that we could all agree on was Punisher Warzone, and I was pissed. because I saw the first Punisher movie, didn't like it, and I had seen the reviews on this one, and like Tommy said, at least initially, the reviews were abysmal, and so I was like, God damn it, I'm going to get dragged to this movie that's probably just going to be like the shittiest of superhero movies. And the first time something kind of darkly hilarious happened, I was totally taken off guard. And it still to this day was one of the most fun experiences at the movies for me, simply because I was with a group of friends that I hadn't seen in a long time. I went in there thinking I was going to have a horrible time and hate every second of it. And when we were all of a sudden like presented with this movie that kind of is a dark comedy or kind of plays with dark comedy elements, that just made it all the funnier for the fact that we weren't even sure if we should be supposed to be laughing or not.
Yeah, because so, I've never seen a sequel that totally goes off on another fork from the first one, because the first one is darker. It takes itself a little more seriously, a lot more seriously. It's more like a, you know, heavy metal.
Do you guys know if Lexi Alexander, if that was just her? Because I can see a version of this where the script just reads like a straightforward Punisher movie, and then she comes in and adds jokes and inserts and stuff like that and just dramatizes things to make it that much darker and excessively violent.
I do think it's Lexi Alexander. Like, I feel like, because the pre-production of this was they wrote the script, or they wrote like multiple different scripts, and Thomas Jane was attached to the project. And then after the script was submitted to Thomas Jane, he was like, I'm out of this. Like, I don't want to touch this shit.
Interesting.
And like, I think they went to like multiple different directors for this movie. And I think Lexi Alexander first passed on the script, as I recall.
They finally ended on an MMA fighter.
But they finally, finally agreed to do it via, you know, whatever her pitch was. So I have to think that it was her that came up with this sort of very, very sort of comical take on the material.
We were talking about this a little bit before. I have a kind of a personal connection to this because I interned for Avi Arad, the producer of this movie, back in the day, 10 years ago now. Fuck.
Tell us a bit of who Avi Arad is.
His story is really cool in Hollywood, or he has a weird story where he was the president of Marvel for a while back in the early 90s. He was president of other toy companies for a while, and then somehow became the president of Marvel, and then through a bunch of Marvel and Sony had a whole thing, you know, where like Sony owns some stuff and Marvel owns some of the stuff, and basically at the end of the day, I think Avi Arad even sued Marvel and somehow ended up with like the rights to Spider-Man and other things like that. So a lot of the Sony Spider-Man stuff is Avi Arad, and then, you know, I don't think he's looked too highly upon in the Kevin Feige part of the MCU anymore. But anyway, so he has like all these properties, and he's kind of like just always notorious for just trying to tinker with them and trying to figure out ways to do stuff.
Well, because he has to make a movie every 2 years to maintain the IP rights. That's why there are so many Spider-Man movies.
Exactly. And so then the Punisher, I feel like he probably, just being around him, he probably was just like, oh, yeah, this will be a good, weird, unique spin. We'll get an MMA female fighter to come and direct this hardcore testosterone-filled
movie. Wait, but didn't you tell me, I remember back in the day you told me that this was his son Ari Arad's maiden voyage.
Baby, yes. I forgot about that part. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me, Jerry. Yeah, his son, who's really cool guy, Ari Arad, this was like his big first movie, and I think it's kind of looked at as a big fuck up in hindsight.
Because it didn't make any money. But anyway, I rewatched this movie this time, and gotta be honest, it's not as epic as I remember it, because I...
You didn't watch it at 1.3 speed?
No, I watched it at 1.0 speed.
Oh, that's where you went wrong.
And the egregious, hilarious violence is pretty few and far between. I remember it being all the time, but there are pretty long 45-minute segments of just dialogue. Mm-hmm. But I still think the movie's super interesting, and I'm excited to talk about it in detail. So without further ado, let's go into a recap.
So, man shoots people.
I wish, but there's so many character names to keep track of in this movie. All right, so vigilante Frank Castle, a.k.a. the Punisher, kills the leader of an Italian crime family, leaving top earner Billy the Butte to take the reins. When the Punisher pursues Billy to a warehouse, he accidentally kills an undercover cop and pushes Billy to a glass compactor, grossly deforming him and turning him into the villain Jigsaw.
Hell yeah, that was awesome.
Upset over the death of the undercover officer, Detective Paul Budiansky, hope I'm getting that right, joins the Punisher task force to take Frank down. While the Punisher also laments the officer's death, Jigsaw looks to recover some lost money from the officer's surviving wife, Mrs. Donatelli, and daughter Grace, whom the Punisher has taken an interest in protecting. The Punisher gets arrested and teams up with Budiansky. Jigsaw and his goons break into Mrs. Donatelli's house, but the Punisher and Budiansky arrest him and hide Mrs. Donatelli and Grace in the Punisher's lair. Jigsaw snitches on a group of terrorists in exchange for his release, recaptures Mrs. Donatelli and Grace, and starts building an army. Frank infiltrates Jigsaw's base, annihilates all the armies, kills Jigsaw, and saves the Donatellis. End of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Not quite meta, but anyway. All right, guys. So one of the reasons why I was inspired to talk about this film is because, and this isn't a, there's a news story that came to my attention that one of our writers mentioned that is not necessarily super recent, but kind of it kind of disturbed me. Did you guys hear that in 2017, there were two different police departments, one in New York and one in Eastern Kentucky, in which the cops would put decals of the Punisher logo decal on top of their cop car.
And I didn't know great. That.
So, of course, this is asinine because the Punisher is a vigilante who acts outside the law in order to enforce his personal brand of justice. His entire conceit is that he's a vengeance-driven anti-hero who acts as judge, jury, and especially executioner. And that's the exact opposite of what cops should aspire to be, which is to act as none of those things. But so that caused a little bit of a shitstorm. The decals ended up going away. But it brought to this kind of bigger conversation about how seriously should we take superheroes? And
not at all.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So, you know,
0%.
We also talked about in our Vampire's Kiss podcast. Have you seen Vampire's Kiss?
I have seen Vampire's Kiss.
So we oftentimes, or in a couple, we mentioned this in our Nick Cage video, but we likened that movie to American Psycho, because American Psycho in both movies are essentially about making fun of 80s yuppie corporate culture. Mm-hmm. But Patrick Bateman is kind of this figure that people kind of pseudo want to emulate, whereas Nicolas Cage's character is just so bizarre and so crazy that you can't identify with him. And I think that, and maybe I'm getting going a little bit too far here, but I think this movie kind of accomplishes something similar.
Hmm.
This film is certainly a departure from the kind of prestige, serious versions of superheroes that we've seen of late, especially the Punisher that we see on Netflix. And even when we have these morally compromised superheroes, we're still asked to identify with them, you know, like Thanos, for example. And in the case of the Punisher, when he's depicted with such venerance, we can't help but root for his brand of justice, especially in the Netflix series. But I feel like this, because it's so ridiculous, and because, especially in a couple parts, like with the violence, it's so alienating that you don't walk away from this movie saying, wow, I want to be like the Punisher, or I see my struggles in The Punisher.
That's so, because I get the opposite thing. Like, this really? Is one of the few, like, usually in, like, a vigilante movie, it's, like, vigilante versus the police, where there's, like, the police is like, oh, we can't have, you know, Batman saving the day, or we can't have, you know, whoever, you know, killing innocent people on the streets. In this movie, the police work hand in hand with The Punisher. Like, literally,
right,
they just
open,
like,
though, you know, it's like kind of under the table.
Yeah, it's under the table, but they're all sort of in the pocket of The Punisher. Like, everybody is just on The Punisher's side. No one is really questioning The Punisher, other than maybe the Colin Salmon, the FBI guy's character.
Okay.
But even he, it's like very like within like 10 minutes, he's on The Punisher's side.
Yeah, the cops are kind of like enablers.
There's nobody that's against him, so.
But I guess I'm thinking more aesthetically, because I feel like the interesting thing about this movie is that it has this grim aesthetic and color palette mm-hmm. that most of your hard-boiled, super serious, prestige superhero movies have, but with characters and lines and violence that undercuts this, and I think that's pretty interesting. So let's first talk about the violence.
Let's.
It's so great. It is... egregiously over the top. The way I spent some time just like, how do I exactly define or describe the violence in this movie? And the best way I can do that is saying that there's like this extra performative irreverence for life. Like, it's not only do mm-hmm. people die, but there's like this extra kind of fuck you to the killing.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of can't help but invite laughter. We talked about something similar when we talked about the John Wick. You know, how we see this guy just mowing down tens of people and not even blinking an eye. And at some point, you just can't help but laugh. And I feel like that's what this movie accomplishes a lot.
I kind of wish that the violence in John Wick was like the violence in Punisher Warzone, because it is another degree. I mean,
yeah,
it's hardcore in John Wick, but it is... super brutal. Without, it's like mm-hmm. less than trauma level of schlocky violence, but it's like, you know, you see their faces cave in an extra millisecond more than you would in a John Wick movie, you know,
or just a face caving in at all.
Yeah, true.
So, I mean, I'm curious what you think, Tommy. Like, so taking all the other elements of the film, the narrative, perhaps you don't like, but what about the violence? Did it tickle you at all? Did you ever find it funny?
I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, every kill is played for laughs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it is funny. I mean, but they are sort of few and far between a little bit.
Yeah,
like, and
not as much as I remember.
Yeah, and it becomes a little bit of the sameness. Like, once you see, like, there's a numbing effect to the violence, at least for me in this movie. Like, once I see the Punisher, you know, stab somebody in the face with a chair.
That didn't tickle
you? No, it tickles me. But then when he shoots somebody in the face in the third act, it's like, well, okay, that wasn't as good as the first act stab with the chair. It's diminishing returns for me, at least in terms of the violence in this movie.
I will say to that effect, I agree with you in this sense. I think that they keep it pretty, have a nice variety of brutal violence throughout, but when he throws the last bad guy, he takes the last bad guy, puts a spear through him, and then throws him on the fire. I mean, that's not as cool as the fucking glass thing we saw in the first one. You should either throw him back into the glass and make it worse and have other more fucked up shit. You should amp it up. I mean, fire, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Spear, whatever. Glass was fucked up 10 minutes into the movie. So I agree.
Yeah.
Continue.
I want to go into just some of the specific things that happen in this movie. So he kills a single man with a grenade launcher while he's in the middle of a parkour move. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was the first one. No. The first one is when he kills the mafia crime lord. And by the way, I remember, I don't know if you still stand by this, but I remember at the time when you were working for Avi Arad, you told me that initial old crime boss was doing an Avi Arad impression.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Really? So he sounds like that, even though he's not Italian? I mean, Avi Arad is Israeli.
He's Israeli, but he has this very, like, Godfather voice.
Really?
Like,
oh.
Like, oh, hey, Ryan, give me some dried mangoes, please, from the cupboard. And
I didn't know that.
Diet
hilarious.
Dr. Pepper. Thank you. He's a very nice guy.
Oh, that's hilarious. I didn't know that. another good part is... you think that Frank is about to spare a guy after he tells him the information that
he
needs.
Oh, that part's awesome.
But then it cuts to him being thrown on a spike 5 stories down, and then the Punisher jumps down and lands on his neck, totally breaking his neck. Yeah, to say the least. I don't know. Something about this really speaks to me. In that,
you just want to throw someone on a spike and then.
Because what the Punisher does is fucked up, you know, and we should, and that should be highlighted. It's not romantic.
Wait, you mean in that instance or just in general what he does?
The idea of
up?
The Punisher is fucked up.
Okay, well, in that specific instance is really fucked up, and it really subverts what most people do in movies, you know?
I know, but
I'm going to put my gun away, and then the next thing you see is on a spike.
Right,
really
I guess
funny.
What I'm arguing is that, yeah, the absurdity highlights that, hey, the Punisher is a fucked up dude, you know? That right now, with the Punisher on Netflix, he is this romanticized, morally compromised anti-hero that we all... basically, God, you know, if I was in that situation, I would do that too. And I'm not saying that, oh, that's socially irresponsible and we should take Netflix Punisher down. I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that this movie, the enjoyable elements, just cast superheroes and in a different light that's kind of interesting and perhaps even cast it in a light that that the characters deserve to be cast in.
Do you identify with any characters in this movie then?
Well, you know, that's actually another point I wanted to bring up later is that...
I would actually argue that Jigsaw is sort of the protagonist of this movie.
Really?
Certain extent, I think he's actually...
But that's
of,
just because the movie's
the driving,
bad,
yeah,
right?
Well, he's the driving force in this movie in terms of plot stuff. Like, the Punisher is very reactive to whatever Jigsaw is doing. And
To that point, really, to both of y'all's points, there's two kinds of superheroes, right? There's the kinds that that kill, and then there's the kinds that don't kill, you know? And I feel like those are the kinds that kill are always making a point about how they kill. You know, like there's Judge Dredd, there's Punisher, there's Deadpool. And then, like, that's intrinsic to their character that they don't wait for fucking justice. They're not, you know, like they're going to take matters in their own hands. And that's a big – you're supposed to wonder, you know, the –
Judge Dredd is a good comparison because I haven't seen the one with Sylvester Stallone, but I did see the most recent one.
They're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie is also a bit ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's self-aware in its ridiculousness.
Yeah.
And I think that it kind of accomplishes something similar in that, yeah, you go away with kind of a testosterone high of like, fuck yeah, you know, just like, follow the law, bitch.
I would.
That's the premise of Judge Dredd.
Never seen that come out of you, Derek.
but it's meant to be taken as a bit silly, which I think is an important distance to create.
Mm-hmm. And you think that this is just not, it's not silly or?
What is this? No, I think Punisher. This is silly. Oh, yeah. I guess the thing I'm contrasting it to is like the Netflix Punisher.
Gotcha. Okay.
Who is like this, once again, kind of romanticized tragic figure.
Yeah, which is more serious. You're supposed to really wonder about.
Now, I should say this. I should stipulate. I've only seen season one and the Daredevil season two that he's prominent in. So I haven't seen season two of the Punisher. So have you seen any of it?
I've seen the first season. I haven't seen the second one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they might address this in ways that I'm not aware of. So just making that stipulation. Another good point, another part I like is how nobody really reacts very strongly when a guy gets a wine glass through his neck when Jigsaw is meeting with the Russians.
They stand, Jared. They stand up. And then they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The same thing basically happens in The Dark Knight with the pencil thing.
Yes.
But somehow, like, tonally, it works. Like, we, you know, like, that never is ridiculous. Or at least, like, cartoonishly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like this is.
The pencil thing wasn't ridiculous to you?
It was funny. But
yeah,
it didn't break the reality of the scene for me. Like this, like, which happens regularly in this movie.
I never am like thinking that the reactions are too subdued. I mean, I'm more just shocked by the violence, and then
Yeah, I mean, this was a minor example.
To go, oh shit, that guy got a wine through bottle through his head,
or like, hey, is he still alive?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've seen that scene so many times where the people are at a table and there's one person who's daring to talk back to the boss. It's like the Kill Bill scene or anything like that. You're just like, oh, it's not a question of like if this person's going to die. It's a question of how this person's
right,
going to die.
Right, but Kill Bill is similarly has comedic elements. Anyway, this is one of my favorites. Jigsaw's brother, Looney Bin Jim, has a hospital worker that feeds him applesauce. This hospital worker takes one bite of the applesauce to make it look appetizing to Looney Bin Jim. And then once freed, Looney Bin Jim proceeds to tear him apart with his bare hands because he, quote, wants his applesauce back. I remember busting out laughing in the theater when that happened. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. Another part, I'm curious if you guys found this funny. So Frank's friend, who is taxed to protect Mrs. Donatelli and Grace in the lair, he gets axed in the chest twice and is somehow still alive hours after the blows were dealt.
He's missing an arm. I don't know if you've noticed that. He's like literally half his like body is hanging off of him.
Yeah. I remember laughing about that in the theater when I was watching this by myself. I was like, and there are a couple times in the movie where I'm like, is this supposed to be funny or not?
Oh, I think they're very aware. They're hyper aware that this is funny.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then the other one that Ryan already mentioned is the Punisher crushing a guy's face with a punch, which is pretty glorious to watch.
Wow.
Now I want to talk about parts that are more explicitly comedic. So I think the biggest, maybe one of the biggest tell-alls about how this movie is going to perhaps undercut the seriousness is the casting of Frank's sidekick. I don't know the guy's real name. I'm always going to call him Newman.
Wayne Knight? Wayne Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's weird, right?
He's just a funny guy.
Yeah, I feel like this is like another trope of like these superhero movies where it's like if you look in Daredevil, like Kevin Smith is, I think, like Ben Affleck's like go-to guy. To sort of Q in James Bond is sort of the comic relief, I guess, of that series.
But even Kevin Smith in Daredevil is dressed up like a scientist. He looks like he's playing the part, but
you don't buy Wayne Knight as an arms dealer?
No, I don't. I really don't.
But that's the thing, is that he's supposed to not look like an arms dealer because he's supposed to be like in hiding, you know? Like you don't want an arms dealer to look like an arms dealer. You want him to look like Wayne Knight.
So when you saw that, you didn't think that it was kind of part of the comedy or...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay, that's all I'm trying to say.
Comedic effect, but I mean, but I also bought the character, too, you know?
Yeah.
He's also one of the few people to actually play this movie straight, I think, Wayne Knight. Like, I don't feel like he's going for the jokes in this movie, oddly enough.
Yeah, he doesn't play it up like there's the other cop character, the blonde cop, who is kind of the goofy cop comic relief.
Dash Mihawk goes big in this one.
Wayne Knight doesn't really have to, though.
Yeah, but everybody else
his existence is a meme.
He's already Newman. Imagine being Newman 24/7.
There's also a part where fat guy in the toilet's head explodes. That one was real weird.
Wait, he's in the elevator shaft, right?
He's on the elevator.
I love that one. That one is so funny. That was just short and sweet. You never see that guy again. He's 1 second and he explodes.
Like, if you were to take that moment out of context, it's good. But, like, I started to, like, think about it. Like, this guy is just sitting in the elevator. All these, like, gunfights are going on outside. And then he's surprised when Castle opens up the doors and shoots him. Like, what was he thinking was going to happen? Is he, like, surprised? Like, he didn't hear the gunfire?
Yeah, for one, elevator shafts are soundproof.
It's open. There's an opening in the... Because Castle sees the smoke coming out. That's how he gets him.
Right. Oh, yeah, because he's smoking. Well, he's sitting there, you know, he's a fat
just,
guy just having
he's just
a,
chilling while everyone else is shooting?
Yeah,
is that
like he's trying to wait it out, and then he's like, oh, shit, like, I didn't hide.
Like, look, I'm not trying to logic out the Punisher war zone.
Right,
yeah,
and we could be here all day.
we could be here a long time. Yeah. But it did, like, I was like, this moment exists out of context well, but in context, it doesn't make any sense.
Sure. All right, let's talk about one of my favorite parts of the movie, and that is the final shot. So a guy is trying to mug the goofy cop out of, what was the actor's
name? Dash Mihawk. I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but
okay.
Yes.
And in the background, we see a neon sign on a church that says, Jesus saves. The Jesus part fizzles out, and then the Punisher comes up and shoots the guy in the head, and it goes to black, and the goofy cop says, great, now I have brains on my jacket. End of movie. All right, so Tommy.
Yeah, I love it.
So... Yeah, I feel like I'm just kind of beating a dead horse here with how I think that, I mean, it's funny, the Jesus thing definitely takes all the kind of redemptive qualities out and makes it pretty clear as day that, hey, this is not a hero. And yeah, I guess...
Wait, you don't think that makes him a hero? I mean, the Jesus goes out and it's Punisher saves. Like, he's the savior. That's the argument at the end of this movie.
It's interesting that you say that. I can see that now. But I still think that there's a reading that the argument is that, like, hey, there's no saving going on here. Mm. That this is just a man's quest for vengeance. And
kind of like Jigsaw.
There's no justice. There's just a... What do you mean?
Well, Jigsaw says, you know, stop praying to your imaginary friend or something like that to the little girl. Remember? Whenever.
Oh, right. Yeah.
This is a very nihilistic movie. I mean...
Definitely. I mean, just the violence itself.
The world's fucked up, and who's going to fix it? If Punisher is. God damn it, if the police can't do it...
Okay, so...
Bring on the Punisher. Who else will, Jared?
You mentioned the thing about whether the Punisher is actually a good guy or a bad guy, and I'm having a hard time really nailing how self-aware this movie is as a, quote, bad movie, because one of the
bad movie? What the fuck are you talking about?
This is a great movie.
I like the movie a lot, but, okay, so one of the things that really stands out to me is the actress that plays Mrs. Donatelli is really bad. Did you guys feel that?
Mrs. Donatelli is the wife of the mobster? Or who?
No.
No, that's Julie Benz. Is that who you're talking about? The mother who's the widow's wife.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Yeah.
Did you get the same impression?
She was not she was not the best actress.
She has a thankless role here, I think. There's nothing to do with it.
Are you saying it's like Sharknado bad? Like
maybe.
See, I wouldn't say that.
But in the sense that I'm saying at the end of the film, Mrs. Donatelli tells Castle that he's one of the good guys. I don't think that she's deliberately playing it bad, but I do think that her performance is a step down from most other people in this movie. And I don't know, I found myself asking, are we supposed to believe that he's actually a good guy in this movie? And because even if you were to argue that, well, he saves Mrs. Donatelli and Grace, he's a good guy. I mean, he's really just doing it because he feels guilty about his son. It's pretty selfish. His son and his wife.
Selfish?
Yeah, there's all these flashbacks of him like wanting to make it right with his family. I'm saying that.
Yeah, but he can't make it right with his family. That's the point. He it's over with his family. His family's
dead.
Well,
I'm not saying
Goodbye.
That it's actually going to make a difference, but psychologically.
It's not like, oh, he's getting anything out of this, really. He's fucking going through hell to help people because he wishes he could go back in time and help his family. How dare you, Jared?
Okay, what about the performance thing?
I see where you're coming from because it is a shitty performance, but I think that that's just, like you said, she didn't have much to work with, and that's less, I think that Lexi edited what she had in front of her, and I don't think that it was meant to be shitty.
It's unfortunate because that actress kind of gets thrown under the bus because other supposedly, quote, serious moments are kind of just brushed by. Like, for example, when Newman, I'm just going to call him Newman because he's always going to be Newman for me. Newman dies. And we feel absolutely nothing. It almost, once again, comes off as a bit of a joke when he just gets shot in the head. No remorse, no grief, no even scene where Castle is looking at him and feels regret.
That's not true.
I don't think that's
because
true.
Because whenever he's like, just shoot me. Just shoot me. You're supposed to think, oh, man, you're sacrificing yourself for these people. And then basically he takes him up on that. He tries to kill both and fucks up. He knows he's not going to be able to get Newman, really, but he goes for the other guy, makes sure he gets the gun off of the girl, and then whatever happens to Newman, you know, his friend, whatever, he's an arms dealer that he can deal with it.
Yeah, that's how I perceived it, too. And also they have that moment after they leave the hotel, and I think it's Colin Salmon's character, the FBI cop, he asks, like, what about, you know, Newman? Or what about that Wayne Knight character? And they're like, oh, he didn't make it.
I guess I'm saying.
I mean, there is that like that moment.
There are few times in the movie where there's any kind of seriousness, and I feel like it was all piled on the shoulders of the actress who plays Mrs. Donatelli.
I agree; those scenes are definitely out of place in the movie. She's at a different tone than the rest of the movie.
Yeah,
it doesn't carry over.
Everything else is under the seriousness is undercut, and it seems like in order for the movie to have any kind of arc or moral center, she just had to say this line that wasn't going to work no matter what.
No, it feels like they shortchange her arc. Like, it doesn't make her motivations don't make sense in this movie. Like, she hates the Punisher. He killed her husband, and then he saves her once, and then she's like, I love you, Punisher.
Yeah.
Thank God for you.
Right.
Like, he's the one that got them in this situation.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, and I forgot one of my favorite moments. It is, where is it? Oh, so Budiansky enters the office of the Punisher Task Force, and you guys know what I'm talking about.
Does so the old library.
It says, which drawer do I look at? The alleged Punisher murders. And then he just goes, all of them. And it's this, I don't want to say it's quite as big as the end shot of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where there's like that huge warehouse, but it is a office room filled with thousands of papers, and we're meant to believe. And this is more what I'm talking about is...
It's a great cut.
I want to know what he was going to get from those files. Like, what was he going to learn from them? Oh, how the Punisher killed this person?
Well,
this way?
But see, I'm wondering, it's like, okay, so the Punisher has killed literally thousands of people. Are we meant to believe... There's no real guidance here. It's like, are we meant to believe that, wow, he really cleaned up the city, or are we meant to believe that this guy doesn't give a fuck and he just kills indiscriminately and...
He killed the bad guys.
Yeah, he only kills, like, the first time he kills an agent, an undercover agent.
He feels real bad.
He feels, like, horrific. He's going to retire. Like, I think the thought is he only kills only bad guys
yeah,
up to this point.
But there is this kind of relishing in the excess of killing thousands of people. Mm-hmm. Which
of bad guys.
Yeah, of bad guys, though.
There's a distinction.
I mean, I feel like they don't go out of their way to make that distinction.
These people are like the worst mafia people, you know?
All thousands of the people in those
the people
files.
That we, everybody that we see him kill,
sure,
you know, is
fucked up. In the series of like 3 days that this movie takes place.
Right, so then you can extrapolate that to the files. You
right,
know?
All thousand of those people must have been horrible.
Right, I mean, I bet the city's
I actually think that's what this movie is arguing.
Yeah. I mean, I believe you. I mean, but I do think that some tonal things are happening in this movie that at least justify bringing mm-hmm. up the question of whether or not, whether this is supposed to alter our take on the, supposed to, or if it functions to alter our, how serious we take superheroes, or especially the Punisher.
Well, they do ask who punishes the Punisher at a certain point in this movie. And then they never answer.
What's the answer?
There is no answer. He just stares. He just stares, like, vaguely at her. I think it's Julie Benz that asked that question. He just stares at her.
Yeah. Also the part where, what was it? It's when the cop is reading him his rights, or this guy's rights, and then the Punisher in a wide shot just comes and shoots the guy in the head, and the guy's like, damn it, Castle!
I love whenever the dude handcuffs him, you know, yeah. And then he's just like, you have the right to shut the fuck up!
Yeah. All right, one other thing I noticed about this movie was some... It's interesting when you revisit movies that were made during the Bush era now, because you start noticing things that are like, oh, you don't really hear those kind of criticisms in movies anymore these days. So, for example, during the Uncle Sam army section where Jigsaw's gathering this army, his brother says, where do we get an army from? And he says, just like Uncle Sam, bro, we recruit in troubled neighborhoods, offer $100,000 toward a college education they'll never get, and promise nobody ever has to go to Iraq. And then...
But then he recruits other gangs. That also confused me.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't recruit, like, the poor people. He recruits, like, the Yakuza and the Irish Mafia and, like...
Yeah. Like, it's a lazy joke. Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to kind of go over the top with it, you could say that, oh, well, you know, they're Asian, black, Irish stereotypes from poor neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But I think probably not that much thought was put into it. and then there's another line where Jigsaw gives up the terrorist in exchange for immunity, and the Punisher says, or I'm sorry, the cop says, unless you got a videotape of Rizzotti talking to them, we can't even give him a parking ticket. And Jigsaw's like, it's a fucked up system you're sworn to protect. And by the way, if that is, we're supposed to look at the police department as inescapably corrupt, and that the Punisher is just from that part, I don't know. It doesn't really work for me.
I don't think the police are corrupt in this movie. Like, typically,
they're not,
and like,
yeah,
they're not corrupt at all. They're just like, they have to make this deal with Jigsaw in order to stop a terrorist attack. Like, they're doing the best they can. It's just the system can't prosecute everybody.
Well, it's the Department of Homeland Security that ultimately hones in on those Russians who are trying to sell bombs to terrorists. But it is depicted, I think, that the Department of Homeland Security basically just comes in, takes over everything, and basically makes it really hard for the local cops to do their job effectively because they take top priority in everything.
This is a sequel to the first one, right? So it's like I feel like we're supposed to, in Lexi's mind, we're already supposed to know that or assume that the Punisher, you know, is a hero, an anti-hero, and you already feel one way about him and that this is just another adventure he's on, you know, kind of a thing. This isn't an origin story anymore.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so I don't remember anything about the first Punisher, so I don't know the lesson we learned at the end of it.
I think they categorize this as a reboot and not a sequel.
Really?
I think that's, yeah, that's the stance on it.
Only because they had to recast Thomas Jane?
Pretty much, I think so.
When was the last time you saw the first movie?
Oh, God, when it came out in theaters?
Okay, yeah, me too, so I don't really remember at all. But it was very grim and serious,
right? It is super serious. They, like, make it like a Shakespearean tragedy where, like, John Travolta, like the Punisher convinces John Travolta that his wife is against him. And then he gets John Travolta to literally, I think, kill his wife and turn on his own people. It's much more like, yeah, it's much more that kind of thing.
All I'm saying is that usually in these kind of movies where we have somebody going against the law, it definitely helps if you depict the law as corrupt because then you're at least showing that there is it's a necessity to have someone like the Punisher. Otherwise, nothing's ever going to get done. We don't really see that in this movie.
No, here they're in stasis. They're like they're compatico. The law gets the criminals they can get, and then if they can't get them, the Punisher picks up the slack.
It's like, a nice it's collaboration.
Very, yeah, it's like, yeah, you're right. They're working together.
Yeah.
I kind of like that it's not the typical corrupt cop guy. I was watching this movie Peppermint with Jennifer Garner, and you're just like waiting, like, oh, who's the corrupt police officer? Oh my God! So I'm glad that like Dash Mihawk isn't like a corrupt working for Jigsaw. You know, I like that he's like
just
working.
Like a goofball.
He's just yeah.
But he is like such a he's a fanboy of the Punisher, and yeah. Anything else you guys want to talk about for this movie?
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
You had talked about whether or not this is a deliberately bad movie.
Not deliberately, but self-aware.
Yeah.
To the point, like, at some point when you're making this movie, you're like, guys, this movie is not going to be good. Let's fuck with it. Let's play it up.
And that's what I don't like about this movie. Like, it lacks sincerity to me. It lacks the conviction of its merits. It's very hyper aware that I feel like Lexi Alexander came on was like, this movie is super dumb. Let me make a movie that's constantly making fun of how dumb it is, and thus it'll be okay. Versus something honest like The Room, where it's like everybody in that movie thinks they're making a great movie, and then it doesn't quite work. They aim for the stars, but they come up short. Here the aim is much less, and
I would say that that's even more thought than what they put into it. To me, it's literally they didn't make a dumb movie; they made an extreme movie. They were like, all right, you know, when instead of your normal action movie, when you know, instead of a normal guy just getting punched, we're gonna have a guy get punched, but you're gonna see it like there's gonna be this extra layer of gruesomeness to it, and because she just wanted to make a hardcore, you know, she's an MMA fighter, she's like, I want to be, you know, make this high octane movie that's more than your average action movie, and I think she did it. It's like a pretty impressive practical effects a lot of times too. Like I think it works. I don't think it's trying to be dumb. It is like I think
it's not trying to be dumb, but kind of resigned itself in embracing a dumbness.
It has this very cold nature to it. It's like, you know, like we were talking about the nihilism of it. You know, like things are people. No one gives a fuck about anybody in this movie or anything, and crazy shit's happening. And I think that's on purpose. And I don't think that that makes it like bad. I think it just makes it like it's a style.
Yeah, I mean, when you call a movie bad, it can mean a lot of different things. I mean,
yeah,
there are movies that I enjoy and like that I still think that there are some, like, if there are poor performances in a movie, especially from a main lead, it kind of renders the movie bad in a way. But that doesn't mean I still can't like it and enjoy it.
I'd say good movie with poor performances rather than bad movie because there's poor performances in it.
Okay.
It's a small distinction.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't believe there are things, such a thing as a movie that's so bad it's good. To you, that's just a good movie.
No, I do. Right? I know what people are talking about when they mean that, but like, you know, I'm with you that you know, there's...
I disagree.
There's good movies, and then there's bad movies, but it's all subjective, but like, the whole like idea that like, oh, I love how shitty this movie is, like, I don't know. You just seem like an asshole.
It rubs me the wrong way, too, and I think it's why I dislike this movie a lot. Because there are movies that you either like or you don't like, but liking a movie because you feel better than it, or that
I love watching The Room, exactly. And I love The Room and stuff, but I love, because I love watching these people like attempting to make a movie and then kind of failing, you know, and that's fun to watch. I would call The Room an awful movie by any normal standard, but I have a great time watching it, you know. Is that a bad, so bad it's good movie? I don't know. I guess so.
I still think that Vampire's Kiss is a better corollary here, because even when they were making that movie, it was like, and I've listened to the director's commentary. They say, like, we just didn't know what the fuck we were doing. Or we were just like, we're making a crazy movie. Fuck it. You know, and that's the kind of feeling that I get from this movie. And the reason why I brought up Vampire's Kiss earlier is because I was arguing that in doing that, they create a character that's impossible to identify with. And I feel like they do something similar here for The Punisher, which I find interesting because it functions very differently than The Punisher that we've seen lately.
You see, for me, The Punisher is the only reserved character in this movie, really. Like, everybody else is so over the top that the only one that you can identify with is The Punisher. Like,
but his actions are over the top. Him punching through a guy's face or rocket launching a guy.
But his demeanor while he does it was just stone cold. Nothing.
Ray Stevenson plays this movie straight, like completely, honestly straight. Like, he never winks at the camera like Dominic
West
does.
You don't need him to do a maniacal, silly laugh after he kills a guy with a rocket launcher. The act itself is ridiculous enough.
Does he even have any like sort of catchphrases in this? I don't think so, right? He doesn't like do any like catch lines or anything like that, right? After he kills somebody.
I'm going to put you out of my misery.
Does he say
Did he say that?
He says that when he throws the guy into the fire.
Right.
Okay.
That's not great. That could be workshopped a little bit. Yeah, he's trying.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, let's go into the mailbag. We got some voicemails up.
Let's do it, man.
Let's see what we got.
All right.
By the way, before we get into that, if you guys want to give us a call, 213-534-8807 or 21-ELF-HUT or ELF-GUT-07. Especially if you want us to feature your version of screaming Show Me the Meaning at the beginning.
Yeah, I really liked the guy today, Rachel, the presidential candidate, who I'm voting for. Please have me as
I'm
your
running
I want to be your running mate, baby. Come on, let's talk. All right, we got Andrew talking about Office Space. Let's hit it, Andrew.
What's up, Wisecrack? This is Andrew here. I'm just calling in. You mentioned something on the last podcast on the Office Space. About a woman that spilled coffee on herself, and I actually gained a pretty exorbitant amount of money. I just want to let you all know that this is actually a really interesting topic. It was part of a large multi-corporate misinformation campaign that you can look into not too many years back, where they were actually trying to create a zeitgeist, kind of like a stigma in America on how easy it was to sue people. And this actually decreased the amount of individuals who were going after companies, because created a feeling in the American public, as well as in the international community, that it was so easy to sue people that it was so much better just not to do it in the first place. And this woman, unfortunately, actually had some pretty severe burns, and her, you know, got pretty messed up. And she didn't receive much money from McDonald's at all. In fact, if I'm correct, she received something around the amount of under $50. It's just really interesting thing, the whole entire idea of corporate America kind of taking over, you know, the public side, guys. Putting an idea out there for their own benefit, just, you know. Hope you have an excellent day.
So, his name was Andrew, did you say?
I forget.
Anyway.
Oh, yes, it's Andrew.
Okay, so Andrew, couple things. One, you're totally right. I was I was undereducated in this, and actually a couple people in the live chat were talking about how she actually was a victim. But more to your point, when I brought that up in the podcast, I was talking about how there was a zeitgeist. Now, whether that was kind of created by corporations, that's the point, is that in the 90s, there was this kind of popular opinion of like, oh, you know, people just suing everybody to get rich. And whether that was created by corporations to protect themselves or it wasn't, it still existed. But yeah, good catch. I apologize for being underinformed on that case. What else we got?
All right. Thanks a lot for the voicemail, Andrew. Appreciate it. Next, we got Joe talking about the Fyre Festival. Let's hit it, Joe.
Show me the meaning!
Oh, hell yeah.
What's up, Wisecrack? This is Joe, who gave you Ryan's Show Me the Meaning last time. We're calling about the Fyre Fest podcast. I just caught up on that one. I was calling with a thought about what you guys are talking about with being in the business of business. Aziz Ansari's character in Parks and Rec, with his company Entertainment 720. It reminds me of my other favorite show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, when Frank and Charlie are doing business, or Frank gets back in business, and Charlie asks the question, like, what do we do? And Frank says, well, what do you mean, what do? We make money. Charlie says, well, what do we make? Like, what do we produce? Frank says, we produce wealth. And Charlie keeps insisting on this, and Frank gets, you know, as Frank Reynolds does, super racist and just says, let the people in China worry about that. But so I have this huge background in theology, and I've actually thought about this a lot, kind of with the way we've industrialized everything. Even things that artisans once made are industrialized, and we've lost the craft of making something from start to finish. Like, if you think about it, like, when's the last time you bought a pair of shoes that someone made every part of that shoe for, and that a factory didn't do it? Or when's the last time you bought a shirt that somebody crafted? They didn't just, you know, use a printer to print some funny slogan on the shirt. So I just kind of wanted to pick your guys' brains on your thoughts on this kind of idea of, like, where we're at. Is that even possible to buy from an independent maker or a creator? You know, because I feel like we all have those friends, but their prices are outrageous, and you'd love to support them, but it's just not realistic for the world we live in. So from the theological standpoint, right, like, it's much better to support the individual, to support the artisan, rather than just the business or the company or the production. Anyway, I wanted to pick your guys' thoughts. Huge fan of everything you guys do. Hope you guys are doing well. Keep it up.
Well, thank you, sir. Ryan, Ryan and Tommy, I know you both saw the Fyre documentary. You were not on that podcast. Mm-hmm. You guys have any thoughts?
Tommy? Yeah, I mean, we live in a world where, you know, corporations can decrease their prices and put, you know, small business owners out of business so easily. I mean, that's how these corporations run. They are able to mass produce things at low prices, put everybody out of business, and then raise their prices afterwards. I will say, though, that the ability to make things now yourself has, I think, greatly improved. Like, there are 3D print models, there are, you know, Etsy, there's, you know, all these different things that you can theoretically do yourself. But it's just so hard to, I think, make a living doing those things, especially when you're up against a billion-dollar corporation.
Yeah, especially because with all those things, it also decreases the barrier to entry, because then anyone can have an Etsy or anyone can do any of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, I think we're in a good time for for people who make stuff, because
Good time for people to make stuff, but a bad time to make money off of that.
No,
stuff.
I think there is a good time to make money off of that. I mean, Patreon, Kickstarter, all that stuff. People are making their living, you know, off of their fans at way more than 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, what? You're never going to compete, you know, go on Shark Tank or something if you want to, like, get your soap into Walmart. But
yeah, we're very fortunate in that sense. Like, I remember when I was a kid, did you guys ever go to newgrounds.com? Like,
yeah.
Like, just early internet comedy and stuff like that. I don't think any of those people worked so hard on some of those animations and those shows, and there was just no monetization back then.
Right.
You know, I don't think any of them ever probably saw a cent. And
probably lost a lot of money.
Lost a lot of money. And so, we're very fortunate to live in a time where there's some monetization for independent content creators.
But if everybody can create it, doesn't that dilute the pool of money? Isn't
Of course.
Yeah. Supply and demand, baby. You got to be good.
It's
get that quality
perfect.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to know like what percentage of YouTubers or people on Etsy can make a living doing just
tiny percent.
That. Yeah.
Oh
so,
well,
yeah.
the amount
yeah.
of people who are on YouTube is so many.
I know.
Anyway, all right. So we're going to go into the emails. You can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. This one is from Patrick, and it's very important. He says, I just want to let you guys know that you inspired me to throw a Nick Cage party this past weekend.
Whoa,
I had
awesome.
Meaning to see Adaptation and Vampire's Kiss for some time, and having watched your podcast on those two films sitting in my watch later queue prompted me to finally act on it. At our Cage party, we watched Face Off, Adaptation, and Vampire's
Triple
Kiss.
Triple feature?
It was a great time. Oh, loved Adaptation.
Nice.
Loved laughing out loud together with / at Vampire's Kiss. I also enjoyed introducing my friends to the zaniness of Face Off.
Hell yeah.
I am interested to hear if that was the actual order. Face Off, Adaptation, Vampire's Kiss. How would you schedule your triple feature for those,
three?
For those three.
I would go Vampire's Kiss 1. Mm. I would go Face Off 2, Adaptation 3.
Dude,
Adaptation
people are tired. You're going to do Adaptation last?
Because Adaptation, no matter where you put it, is the slowest one. And even though how awesome it is, it's like, I feel like that's the endurance movie. You always have the endurance movie at the end. It's like, all right, guys, let's go. We've seen Face Off. We've seen a Vampire's Kiss. It's Adaptation.
I would do Face Off first. That gets everybody amped. Then you do Adaptation. And then that brings everybody
Vampire's
down.
Kiss.
And then the midnight movie is Vampire's Kiss because it's fucking bonkers. And that's how
I start off with the bonkers movie to get everyone on my level.
Yeah, that's right. I would actually do Vampire's Kiss. Then, you know what? No, I would do Adaptation. Then Adaptation just because it's great. But you got to get it out of the way first just because it's a little bit slower.
That's
yeah.
how you kill your party, man. That's how you go, let's get the slow one
man,
first.
You're
that's
starting,
you're like,
you're starting
2 hours
it off,
later.
You're starting it off in the evening, late afternoon. And then when you start getting, it starts getting late. You got a couple drinks in you, whatever. Then you hit them with the face off. And then you hit them. And by the time everyone's blackout drunk, it's time for Vampire's
Kiss.
We
just have different party philosophies,
I guess we do.
Guess.
All right. All right, this next one is from Marcus. This is about Office Space. He said, on the discussion of Peter's transition to construction work, I got a strong sense that the decision was motivated by the view of a happy life in stoicism, almost like Cincinnatus relinquishing power and returning to the farm, ignoring external influences and being happy with whatever task is at hand, to be free from anger, envy, and jealousy. Just a thought for you guys. I like that. I think there's a lot to be said about how he, it's just like his job gives him he's not looking for $1 million anymore. He's kind of resigned that ambition, and now he's just looking to live a decent life.
He's happy on the construction site.
Yeah. All right, one more on Office Space. This is from, I hope I'm getting this right, Inyaki. So she says, I recently listened to the Office Space podcast and was delighted when Alec mentioned the siesta. Unfortunately, so Alec had asked, like, I wonder if siestas even still happen anymore. And so she says, unfortunately, this is pretty much non-existent these days in the workplace in Spain, no matter the origin or type of company. I'm not saying that some people don't still do it, but in urban environments with hectic timetables and long commutes, it's impossible to find time to go home after lunch and have a siesta. Same thing in factories, since people have to adhere to a particular shift. Nowadays, it's pretty much relegated to weekends and holidays, especially if you had a heavy meal or a night out. She goes on to say, on another note, I enjoyed the discussion about the so-called reputation economy with the cases like Uber ratings brilliantly exposed in the Black Mirror episode. I couldn't help but notice that this is something that has been happening in some industries and businesses, such as consulting and finance, since probably the 80s and 90s. I know for a fact that many of the consulting firms and investment banks employ policies like the upper out. Some others routinely fire 5 to 10% of their staff each year, supposedly to avoid stagnation. Apart from business metrics, surely part of the decision process is based off based on appraisals and feedback from colleagues and managers. So it is expected that people will buy into the corporate culture, eventually giving up some aspects of their individuality, or even worse, masquerading them, in order to stick around and don't lose status within the company or ultimately the job. It seems as if companies found the way to make employees police each other. Or was it the other way around, and people in the eternal quest for meaning invented all these rules and cultures in the workplace to feel part of something bigger? So if someone doesn't comply, they will be expelled, just like a tribesman who would be expelled if he didn't collaborate in hunting or other chores in the tribe. I don't know. I'll let you guys discuss it since you probably have more insight. So this is actually something I think about a lot, and I've talked to Alec about this a lot and how I've noticed something, especially in Hollywood, but I think it's all industries, and how there's like an ideological dress code that you have to adhere to be in Hollywood. You know, if you think of ideology like fashion, you know, when I was a kid in middle school and you wanted to be one of the cool kids, you had to wear Abercrombie and Fitch. It was just the thing. These days, if you want to have any hope of making it into a writer's room in Hollywood or pretty much anything, there's an ideological guideline that you basically have to adhere to. And my dad did this. My dad was a hippie, but then he, you know, started working in the financial industry. They had an ideological dress code that was much more conservative than Hollywood. And same thing happened to him. And this really bothers me. Yeah, I think that this idea of, and I don't know if it comes from the top down, like Iñaki is saying, or if it's just something that naturally manifests. I don't really know, but it's something that bothers me.
I will say that the culture in writers' rooms is much more sort of, I think, free thinking than I think it would be in corporate America or a 9-to-5 job. I mean, your job is ostensibly to come up with stuff.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you get every sort of idea possible.
Good to hear.
I mean, yeah, I think that man is an imitative beast. And, you know, you're always going to try to conform. There's always a little bit of conformity, but it seems like there is more now than maybe there what used to be.
Oh, I don't know about that, but it's just the fever pitch is much higher now. And another thing that bothers me is that let's just assume that. So let's say take the financial industry. We'll start talking about Hollywood. If perhaps your beliefs don't line up with the majority of people within the financial industry, but it's a really tough industry and you'll pretty much do anything to make it. If there's a series of things that are keeping you from succeeding or getting that entry level job, and one of them is your beliefs, well, shit, that's easy to change. I could just do that, you know, right now, because, you know, and of course, I don't really know much about the financial industry, but I know in Hollywood, you know, when people's dreams are at stake, people will kind of just give up anything.
Well, also, I mean, there's all.
Isn't that true in any situation, though? Don't we all just want to fit in, and then we seek to modulate ourselves for the crowds? Like, I feel like that's just a human instinct.
Well, there are definitely different elements and different variables that we will modulate to fit into the crowd. I would at least like to think that our beliefs are something a bit holier than, for example, like literally what clothes you wear or what your haircut is or something like that. But I don't know.
You're talking about hanging out, talking about political beliefs and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like more specifically.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, whenever you're around Hollywood, even not in writers' rooms or something like that, all the time people will speak to you as if they understand your, like they know what your politics are, because how could it be anything different? Like you're a human being, right? And
You've heard that saying, you don't talk about like religion and politics around the dinner table.
That's,
you know?
That's gone.
Yeah. That's still around, right? I mean, like it's too, you don't talk about religion and politics ever. Basically, is the new saying, right?
Really interesting.
Well, no, I'm asking really, like.
I mean, look, I've owned my own business for a while now, so I don't really have this experience of going into an office, especially since the kind of culture war fever pitch has hit the high that it has recently. But I've only heard anecdotes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I rarely feel like muzzled or anything. You can say whatever you want. Still, it's more just
that's good to hear.
It's more. No, I mean, just right. But it's more just you're saying the reaction to it. It's more variable, so it's kind of like you just don't feel as comfortable expressing yourself, right? That's kind of what you're saying.
Well, in the example that Iñaki said, so for example, if you're talking about a corporate culture in which like everyone in the office is bought into Casual Friday or something like that. And then if you're the one person that dissents against Casual Friday, I mean, Casual Friday is a bad example because it would probably be something a little bit more
okay.
essential.
We'll say someone's super against Casual Friday. Continue.
Right, but like, or okay, let's say you work for Tom's Shoes.
Okay.
And, you know, you know what Tom's Shoes is? The whole no. idea is that for every pair of shoes that you buy, they give a pair of shoes to kids in Africa. Now, I'm imagining if you work at Tom's Shoes, you are living and breathing that ethos of charity. Now, imagine I worked at Tom's Shoes and I said, hey, guys, you know, this is kind of fucked up and this is kind of bullshit because there are shoemakers in Africa that are being put out of business by Tom's Shoes. And this is actually kind of harming the community's ability to create a whatever, a community that can provide for itself. That might be an unpopular opinion that it would be best, especially if you're not a manager, if you're just an underling, it'd probably be best if you kept that opinion to yourself. And I think that that's kind of what more of what Inyaki's talking
hasn't
about.
Hasn't that always been true, though? Like, I feel like that feels no different than 30 some odd years ago.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I mean, I said the same thing happened to my dad in the financial industry. I'm just saying it kind of sucks. Hmm.
Yeah, kind of. I think I've said this on the podcast before. Like, you know, if you need something, if you need a job, yeah, if you like, probably play it safe. But, you know, the people, unfortunately, that can get away with saying whatever the fuck they want in this country, you know, a la Donald Trump or something, is if you have a bazillion dollars and you literally, all right, I'm not going to lose a job. I'm not going to lose, even if I lose, you know, PR or whatever, who gives a fuck? You know, like, I have all the money in the world. So that's why there's going to be this weird trend, I feel like, where only the, you know, the wellest to do amongst us are going to be able to really have these mouthpieces or feel the most comfortable to say whatever they want. And people who actually have to, like, provide for their families and stuff, it's like, well, I want to fucking say whatever, but I don't want to lose my job, whatever, blah, 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 blah. You know, so it's going to have this weird effect.
Sure.
I mean, we do see repercussions for people in power now that are saying whatever they want. With, I mean, the exception of Trump. I mean, we do see that now. Just off the top of my head, you know, the James Gunn Twitter situation. Like, people.
Well, that's a whole thing.
But that's a company, though. Yeah. That's, you know, there's a difference between that and politics, you know. People that get elected, I guess.
Right. There's also the question of who the fuck cares about Twitter? But that's the whole thing. anyway, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up.
Punisher Warzone. Yeah, yeah.
Punisher Warzone. Where can we find you guys on the internet, Ryan?
I release comedy videos on Ryan Shorts every week. Just released the In Memoriam for the Avengers on there. And you can find me on there or the Funhouse channel, I guess, now. I'm going to be playing Grand Theft Auto next week.
Oh, it's coming out next week.
I think it's a sporadic schedule over there. We'll okay. see.
Are you
Look
any good?
That. No, I fucking suck. That's part okay. of the video, though.
Make sure if you see that video to give Ryan some shit in the comments.
Please do, yeah.
Say why. Tell me where can we find you on the internet.
Sure. I mean, I have a Twitter feed I barely ever am on. So it's
like
at,
a mentally
yeah,
healthy human
just,
being.
Yeah,
good job.
Yeah, at TC4949.
Cool. All right, so in terms of what we got coming up, we're doing the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos documentary.
When's that coming out?
I think that's the week after next, so I don't know what we're doing next week.
Wait.
We're going to have Helen on that one because Elizabeth Holmes was her hero. And then
until
the news came out.
I thought it was going to be like, she became my hero after I heard this story.
No. Before the story
came out.
What
a con.
But anyway, so we're going to do that. We'll probably fit in another movie next week. But until then, we'll see you guys. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California!